Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to church this morning. I'm Kelly Crone Willis. I currently serve as the past president on the board and a variety of other things around the church. I've been a member here for about 5 years. Everyone is invited to stay following this worship service for fellowship and conversation and refreshments in the worker room right behind me through the door. If you're a newcomer here this morning, we extend to you a special welcome and invite you to fill out one of our visitors' cards found in the back of your hymnal and put it into the offering plate or give it to an usher. We'll send you our church newsletter in the next 3 months to let you know about programs and activities going on here at the church. If you have any children with you, they are invited to attend the religious education program when the children leave for their classes a little bit later in the service. We do also have a professionally staffed nursery for infants and young children. And adults are encouraged to attend the adult religious education program at 11:50. If you wish to learn more about this church and about Unitarian Universalism in general, there's an information rack in the fellowship hall here. It's on the wall right behind me on the other side. There you'll find some visitor information that you're welcome to take home with you. Of course, we also encourage you to speak to other members to learn more and encourage current members to seek out any visitors and share with them our beloved community. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. And now I invite you to turn to your neighbors and greet them, especially those you might not know. And I have a couple of announcements this morning. This one has a prop. There are some UUA yellow standing on the side of love bumper stickers for sale out in the worker room.
What's UUA stand for? What does UUA stand for? There we go, for newcomers who don't know.
They're out on the desk across the Kate worker room on the far side. Put $2 per sticker into the jar to get one, and these should be a very supportive indication of our support of those in Ferguson area and around with all that's going on. That's by way of Pat Moore. Pat, are you here somewhere? Yeah, right there. We also want to remind everyone that Fourth Saturday lunch is going to be 12:27. It's like the Saturday after Christmas. Please consider donating any food items or personal care items. There's a bright yellow sign-up sheet over on the worker room table, and it's also sign-up sheets posted in UU Friends' Facebook site. Kathleen McKeever can help with any questions or comments you might have about what's coming up on that day. Sabrina, board president, wanted to let you all know we will get the announcement out in email and whatnot, but this week at our board meeting, we set the semi-annual congregational meeting for Sunday, January 18th. So that's coming up. In case it's a snow day, we're going to go do the next Sunday. And I think the last one I have is we got a letter from the Prisoner and Family Ministry Program of Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. They wanted to thank us for our donation for securing hygiene items for their returning citizens. Your contributions will make it possible for the Prisoner and Family Ministry Program to continue to serve those who are returning back into our community. They sent us a nice letter. I won't read the whole thing because I'll post it on the social Justice Board outside after second service. And I think Sunshine has a couple things.
Morning. A few things. One, today at 11:50, we will have our Inspire program, the documentary Race, the Power of an Illusion. It'll be the second portion, which is the history of how we created race in the United States from about 1800 to about 1900. That will be in here. We'll view it up on the screen here. Again, that's 11:50, and it takes almost exactly an hour. So you are welcome to attend that, and then we will show part three in December. If you are interested in being a worship associate, this is our new worship associate program. We will be somewhat sadly replacing liturgists with worship associates. These are folks who are committing to being trained to speak in the pulpit, to handle emergencies if they arise during worship, and to preach once during the summer. Opportunity to get to spend some time with me, the minister, to do some spiritual development, and also to help with the worship life of the church. If you're interested, the deadline for the application is tomorrow, but I am willing to accept extensions for another week if you ask me. So we are particularly in need of men and non-cisgender women to apply. So if you are interested, please contact me. Please note that I will be on vacation starting Christmas Day until January 6th. If there's an emergency, I will return, but please know that that is coming up and that we will be closing the office here at the church from Christmas until New Year's Day. So if you need anything from Becky, make sure you contact her well before Christmas. And then the final thing is next week will be our winter solstice service. If you are pagan and interested in assisting with the service, please contact me after worship today. And that'll be all. Thank you.
And we begin our service this morning with a prelude. Our call to worship this morning is from the words of Tim Haley. Amid all the noise in our lives, we take this moment to sit in silence, to give thanks for another day, to give thanks for all those in our lives who have brought us warmth and love, to give thanks for the gift of life. We know we are on our pilgrimage here, but a brief moment in time. Let us open ourselves here, now, to the process of becoming more whole, of living more fully, of giving and forgiving more freely, of understanding more completely the meaning of our lives here on this earth. I apologize, I didn't ask the ushers if we have a chalice lighter.
We do.
Okay. As we light the chalice, would everyone join me in reciting? Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Our opening hymn is number 354, We Laugh, We Cry. Please rise as you are able, and the words are projected behind me.
We dance, we sing our song.
of you like to ask the question, why? What about how? I'm a big fan of how. Gets me in trouble sometimes. I take things apart and then I can't put them back together again. Anybody ever do that? I took the telephone apart once when I was a kid. Never heard the end of that one. Anybody like to ask who? Well, that one's a little less. Well, today is a story about a who named Maria Mitchell. Who knows who Maria Mitchell is? A few of you, yes. If you watched Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson, she was featured. And she was a Unitarian Universalist. And this is a story about young Maria Mitchell. She lived from 1818 to 1889. It was a long time ago, and it was at a time when women didn't have a lot of power. So once there was a little girl named Maria who was full of questions. When she was two, she asked, "What? What is that? And what is this? And what are those? And what are these?" Her parents answered as best they could. I'm sure some of you know how that goes. "That's a dog, and this is a cat, and those are dog's whiskers, and these are cat's toes, and no, you shouldn't bite them." Her parents gave her lots of answers, but she always had more questions. When Maria was three, do we have anybody here who's three? 3-year-olds? Okay. When she was three, she started to ask, "How? How does this work? And how does that happen? And how do we get, how do we know how it goes?" And her parents tried to answer as best they could. "Well, boiling water makes steam, and steam pushes the lid off the kettle. And we know because, well, because we do, okay?" "But how," Maria wanted to know, "how do you know?" "Well, because we look at it, and we wonder, and we do experiments to find out answers. You know, you can do experiments, too. Anybody here like to do experiments at home?" I once tried to mix toothpaste with icing. That wasn't a very good experiment. When Maria was four, she started to ask, "Why? Why do boats float? And why does it get it dark at night? And why do cats have fur? And why do people wear clothes?" Her parents tried to answer as best they could, but no matter how many answers they had, Maria always had more questions. She asked questions at home, she asked questions at school, she asked questions at the Quaker church where her family belonged. She asked questions of everyone she met. Hundreds of questions, thousands of questions, millions of questions, an infinity of questions from one little girl. Maria had an infinity of questions, and she also loved the infinity of the stars. How many of you like to look up at the stars, the infinity of the stars? They're pretty cool, huh? In the evenings, she and her father would climb to the stairs to the top floor of their house in Nantucket, Massachusetts, which is way out east, over by the sea. Then they would climb up a ladder and get to the roof. On the roof was a small platform with a railing around it, called a widow's walk. And from the top of the house, Maria could see far out to the sea and far above to the stars, hundreds of stars, thousands of stars, millions of stars, an infinity of stars. "I love the stars," she told her father, and they would look through a telescope to see farther in the sky. Then Maria would start to ask questions. "Where do stars come from? How old are they, and why do they shine? How many are there? How far are they?" Has anybody ever tried to count the stars? Yeah. You never stop, do you? Yeah. Some questions her father could answer, some he could not. So Maria set out to find answers for herself. She studied hard and read many books and did experiments, and she became an astronomer, a person who studies the stars. And when she was 29 years old, she discovered a comet, which was named the Mitchell Comet, after her. The King of Denmark gave her a medal for discovering that comet. In 1848, she was named a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which had never had a woman member before. But Maria was still full of questions. How do we know God exists? Is all of the Bible true? Why are we here? Some people gave her answers, but when Maria asked, "How do you know?" they answered only, "Because we do." because we read it in a book, and so that's the way it is, and we shouldn't ask anymore. Anybody ever have that happen to them? Don't ask any more questions about God. I've had a few of those. Maria didn't think those were very good answers, though. But the answers to her questions weren't to be found in books or doing experiments, so Maria kept asking. And one day, she heard a talk by a Unitarian minister named William Ellery Channing. He didn't have answers either, but there was room for an infinity of answers to an infinity of questions, and the important thing was to wonder, not to know. How many of you find it easy to wonder and not to know? How many of you hate wondering and not knowing? Yeah, that's a hard one for some folks. Maria decided to join the Unitarian Church because those words woke up her mind. All through her life, Maria Mitchell asked what and how and why. She became a teacher so she could help other people answer their own questions. In 1865, she became a professor of astronomy at Vassar College, and she taught other people about the stars. Sometimes they found answers to the questions, and sometimes they didn't. But Maria Mitchell was happy either way, because the most important thing is to wonder, and not always to know. And that is Maria Mitchell. So now I invite you, those of you who are young and have classes, to go to their classes.
Please join me in responsive reading. It's number 653, Reflection on the Resurgence of Joy. And the words are posted on the wall behind me. How short the daylight hours have now become. How gray the skies, how barren seem the trees.
A damp and chilling wind has gripped my mind and made me gloomy too.
But there is that in me which reaches up towards light and laughter's bells and carolers.
And knows that my religious myth and dream of reborn joy and goodness must be true.
Because it speaks the truths of older myths.
That light returns to past darkness, life surges in evergreen and in us.
And babes are hope, and saviors of the world, as miracles abound in common things.
Rejoice and join in gladness of the holiday season.
I invite you now to move to the microphone and share briefly any gratitude or celebrations you bring with you to church this morning. There will be time to share sorrows in a few moments.
I have a joy from Robin Berkeley. I got an email from her last night. She says she's getting stronger every day, and she's finally got her medications balanced. She's exceeding the expectations of her therapy, and she says that she's hoping she'll be here for the solstice service, but for sure on Christmas Eve.
That's excellent news. I have two joys. One, I had the privilege of having dinner at Lucy Boughton's house yesterday, and that was fabulous. And the second is I want to offer congratulations to our accompanist, Rachel, who is graduating from her, is it two master's degrees? Just one master's degree in engineering this coming weekend. So congratulations to her.
Now I invite you to come to the microphone and share briefly any sorrows or concerns you may bring with you to church today. You May the gratitude and celebrations among us this day become a blessing to all. And may the concerns and sorrows that each be carried in all our hearts and a burden shared becomes a load lightened.
I invite you now to join me in a time of prayer, meditation, or contemplation, as is your own personal spiritual practice. I invite you to take notice of the room around you, to get comfortable in your pew, to notice your breathing. In the chaos of our lives, it is good to take time to be in silence and to just be present. The holiday season often brings many more tasks and errands that we must run, completing projects for end of school years, so many things that must be done. So take this time to be with your body now. Take a deep and slow breath in and out. And now, so your neighbor can hear you, in and out. And one more time, in and out. I invite you to notice the sounds around you, to notice the feel of the air on your skin. Feel of your body on the pew or chair. You're now in a season of wonderment, a time of taking stock and of being into the silence, into the cold of winter. We open our minds and our hearts, our bodies and our spirits, to a world both troubled and joyful, to lives both troubled and joyful. For those experiencing times of pain, of illness, we offer our presence and our grace, for we know that alone, pain and illness can feel overbearing, overpowering. But in community, with the supporting love of others, it can become manageable. We offer blessings in this time of trial in our country to African Americans who too often experience violence again and again, implicitly and explicitly, to Native Americans who yet again find their lands being stolen, in this time of trial and uncertainty, when it may be hard to hear and understand one another, may we stay at the welcome table, having the hard conversations, and being willing to be transformed by what we hear. And in this time of trial, not just in the United States, but in the world that is at many wars, experiencing many natural disasters, we offer our blessings, our commitment, and where we can, our money and our energy to helping bless the world. And we lift up times of joy and celebration for graduations and children, for family, for good food that comes with this season, for the power of this community to do good and to be loving in the world. I invite you now into a time of personal meditation, prayer, or contemplation.
as you come back into this space, I invite you to take a deep and slow breath in and out. One more time so your neighbor can hear you. In and out. In the grace of this day, in the support of this community, and in the beauty of the world, may we receive and give light and love, hope and wonder. May it be so.
Each week, we take a collection of money, of bounty, from this community to support the work of this congregation and of Unitarian Universalism. We do this because we recognize that individually we cannot do as much as we can as a community. We invite you to give until it feels good, to give what you can, and to know that your gift matters. It is through your hands and hearts that we make a world worthy of our children and our children's children. This gift is a piece of the precious light that shines for the world to see. This morning's offering will be gratefully received. May it be joyfully given.
Of eyes meeting over the noise and holding fast. It's the season of scars and of wounds in the heart, of feeling the full weight of our burdens. It's the season of bowing our heads in the wind and knowing that we are not alone in fear, not alone in the dark. Don't forget, I love you.
Please join me in reciting our offertory blessing. To the work of the church, which is
weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves and these our offerings.
Our reading this morning is A Common Destiny by David Eaton. All living substance, all substance of energy and being and purpose are united and share the same destiny. All people, those we love and those we know not of, are united and share the same destiny. Birth to death, this unity we share with the sun, earth, our family, strangers, flowers of the field, snowflakes, volcanoes, and moonbeams. Birth, life, death, unknown, known, unknown. Our destiny from unknown to unknown. I pray that we will know the awe and not fall into the pit of intellectual arrogance in attempting to explain it away. The mystery can be our substance. May we have the faith to accept this wonderful mystery and build upon its everlasting truth.
You into a moment of imagining. If you find it helpful to imagine with your eyes closed, please feel free to do so. And I want you to imagine a dark night in a forest. The ground is covered in a foot of snow. It is 4 a.m. The predators of the night have just gone to bed, and it's not quite time for those of twilight to rise. Is a time of peaceful silence. In this silence, the air feels close. In this silence, you stand there, alone and yet connected to all that is around you. In this time, 4 a.m, in the coldest of winter, I invite you to wonder about your surroundings.
to be in that magical space of nature. One of the great gifts of the mind is the power of imagining. And so as you come back into this space thinking about the sermon today, I invite you into that mindset of wonder. There are so many themes that come from the various religious traditions that celebrate holidays this time of year. You can talk about darkness and light. You can talk about going inward. You can talk about the birth of children, themes within themes. But perhaps the most important one for a thoughtful mind is that of wonder, of embracing that which is beyond our capacity of knowing, of asking questions about those things which are complicated, about embracing the wonder that is this amazing world we live in. Each of us, little specks on a giant planet that is a little speck in a giant solar system, that is a little speck in a giant galaxy, that is a little speck amongst millions of galaxies, beyond which we don't have the capacity to know, but can wonder what's even beyond that. The miraculous in the real. As a humanist myself, I used to find this holiday a bit of a struggle. And me and my friends in high school would celebrate what we called Winter Festival, because we had many different religious traditions in our little cohort, and it seemed to be more balanced and diverse to have one common holiday that we could engage in. But at the heart of Winter Festival was community and family and friends and a time of being kind of outside the school year and outside of the world for a little bit, and our own time of wonder and creativity. And for a group of weird, dorky, geeky LGBTQ teens, there was no place better. It was a time to wonder about ourselves and to wonder about the world around us and to consider possibility. And indeed, this season invites us into that space. It's a time apart in a way, a time set aside. And whether you are a person who celebrates Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or New Year's or none of it or solstice, it's a time of being in community, and it's a time of recognizing that as a society, we do things just a little bit different, and not always does it have to do with shopping. Is a time of wonder and of engaging in a spirit of what I like to call moral imagination. And moral imagination invites us to use our thoughtfulness, our reason, and our insight, and our personal experience to imagine how the world might be different and transformed by one another and by the world around us. The moral imagination. Even in the story of Jesus, you hear the moral imagination at work. An infant born at a time of oppression, a king bent on killing a baby barely born, the three wise men, outsiders to this land, who indeed faced their own oppression in this region, coming to an infant and saying yes to life, to the wonder and miracle of the stars and the sky and the gift of life, of shepherds and animals, of the most unlikely bedfellows. And in this moral imagination, imagining the possibility that the world need not always be the way it has been. It's a world of possibility, of us imagining ethically how we might improve our lives. And in this day and age, as we face the struggles of conversations around race, around war, around illness, we need that moral imagining, that moral wonderment more than ever. It helps us into a new place. Solstice invites us to imagine a world of being connected with the earth, with the directions, with beings and entities beyond ourselves, of recognizing that feeling source that exists not just within people and animals, but within the world itself. And I would argue at the heart of a humanist life is the power of that moral imagination to help transform the world. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with humanism, I want to take a minute and explain. Humanism started around the mid-1800s as a concept and started to grow significantly after World War I. It essentially said that science and reason and the faculties of the human spirit were the foundations for change. Frequently, it set aside religion, but not always. And it certainly said that it was within humanity to heal the world. It had a rude awakening when World War I occurred. And people started to doubt the powers of people because so much violence had occurred at the hands of humanity and so many people had died, that faith in human endeavor and human capacity for change was called into question. It was around this time that two ministers, Reverend John Dietrich and Reverend Curtis Rees, founded what is called religious humanism. You will find Curtis Rees familiar because he was a minister in this congregation from 1913 to 1915. And in 1917, while he was a minister at the Des Moines congregation, he preached what was considered to be the first specifically humanist sermon. In that sermon, he essentially supported the value of democracy, the value of the mind, the importance of reason and logic, all of which are longtime Unitarian inherited values. For even in the 1500s, Unitarians argued against the Trinity with the pure use of reason and the Bible. In the early 1800s, our Unitarian forebears used reason to understand and read the Bible, and that has been a foundation of our religion since long before humanism, long before humanists and atheists began attending our congregations. The first humanist manifesto was signed in 1933. Reverend Curtis Rees was one of those signees. The majority of them were Unitarian ministers. It is also worth noting that all of them were white men. About 20 years later, the second humanist manifesto was signed by a mixture of white and African-American men. And by 1970, we started to see some women signing that manifesto. And today, humanism is very much alive. It is very active in the world. It is an international affair with people from all kinds of cultures and worldviews participating in it. The most recent declaration or manifestation of the Humanist Manifesto is now called the Amsterdam Declaration from 2002. And I find that one section of that declaration is particularly powerful when we're talking about this concept of wonder and of the moral imagination. They write, "Humanism is a life stance aiming at the maximum possible fulfillment through the cultivation of ethical and creative living, and offers an ethical and rational means of addressing the challenges of our times. Humanism can be a way of life for everyone, everywhere. Our primary task is to make human beings aware in the simplest terms of what humanism can mean to them and what it commits them to. By utilizing free inquiry, the power of science, and the creative imagination for the furtherance of peace and the service of compassion, we have confidence that we have the power, we have the means to solve the problems that confront us all. We call upon all who share this conviction to associate themselves with us in this endeavor." The power of science and creative imagination. Isn't that just a powerful thought all by itself? And it takes that science and that creative imagination to imagine ourselves out of some of the greatest struggles we face. Global warming, hunger, violence. Just recently, I watched the movie Interstellar. Anybody seen Interstellar yet? That is a spectacular movie. I'm still thinking about it and dreaming about it today. And in Interstellar, they use the best known science, particularly the science of Stephen Hawking and so many others, to imagine what might it mean that the world, the Earth, will not always be our home. The reality that at some point this planet will be done with us. And what might we do? Will we die off, or will we move on into the universe and find other homes? And it uses that moral imagination to try and figure out how we might get out of a situation of this Earth no longer being our place, our space. And it does it not just through science and reason, which it does wonderfully well, but it creates a thought experiment of what it means to also have community and heart be at the center of that imagined future. Whereas our humanists have said in their declaration, furtherance of peace and in the service of compassion. We teach our children to be in that wondering place. Any of you participate in Spirit Play Classroom teaching it? Our Spirit Play classroom is, I think, particularly hard for adults because you tell a story and then you ask wondering questions of the children. And the number one job of the person who's asking the questions is not to provide an answer. And inevitably, the adult fails. Because they want to say, well, have you thought about this and this and this? But the value of Spirit Play, the value of the way it is set up, is that we help our children use their own ethical imaginations, find their own strength and their own reason and experience. And when we don't provide the answers and let them wander into the world, they find their own path. And I have taught that class numerous times, and every time some kid asked a question that I'm thinking about weeks later, like, wow, where did that come from? The power of wondering and letting people wonder in their own ways. And yet it's hard for us to be in that space. As adults, I think it's worth learning to wonder without having an absolute answer. Wondering without having an absolute answer. And so Reverend Tom Owentoll puts it like this. We come to our religious values experientially. The beliefs we hold are not so much revealed to us as experienced by us. We encourage our children to develop their own working wisdoms instead of their inheriting the truth of their parents or of tradition. All who would participate in our Unitarian Universalist cradle-to-grave religious adventure have the opportunity to develop a faith that is personally meaningful, intellectually sound, socially relevant, and spiritually expressive. We are not ashamed to confess that truth comes in small installments. Those modest and well-lived insights are sufficient to sustain a fulfilling existence. Truth comes in small installments. I don't know about you, sometimes I get a little impatient for those installments to get a little bigger, or a little more, or a little faster. And yet, the spirit of this season, of the holiday season, reminds us to engage in wonder in such a way that's slow. I like the Advent calendar because it invites you into a day-by-day practice over a period of weeks, of engaging in the wondering and the spirit of asking the questions of the season. It doesn't lead you into an absoluteness. And whether you believe in Christianity or not, I think the power of taking those small installments day by day, little bit by little bit, help feed our spirits, our minds, and give us the patience to have that moral imagination, the patience that it takes to solve some of the biggest problems of our world, because goodness knows it's not going to get solved in our lifetime, right? Anybody think we're going to solve racism in our lifetime? War? Hunger? It's not going to happen in our days, so small installments of the moral imagination. The holiday season invites us into an annually ritualized engagement with our senses, with our existence in the world. And utilizing our reason and our creativity, we can explore more deeply the beauty of the earth, the importance of people and of relationships, and the many gifts we have in our lives, both physical and immaterial. I'm going to close today by talking a little bit about Charles Hartshorne. He is a minister, was a minister, and a theologian. And I use theologian not as the full and thorough study of God as some man in the sky, because he was what is called a process theologian. And process theology uses reason and the knowledge of the allness of the universe, everything that we know and don't know, as a way to understand our world and our lives. He tells this story. He was serving as a soldier in World War I, and he was in France, and he was feeling pretty despairing. The war was tough. His life was a struggle. He was not feeling joy. It was not a good day. And he walked out to the edge of the cliff. He was kind of looking out and disparaging and not really feeling connected to the world. And at some point, he realized he heard this loud cacophony of sound. And at the base of the cliff, there were a group of French school children laughing wildly. And he realized in that moment that just because he was despairing and not seeing beauty in his own life did not mean that beauty didn't exist in the world. And he wrote it this way. He said, "Never since then have I allowed myself to identify, unless briefly, the question of is life good and beautiful with the question, is my life now good and beautiful? And I have not wavered in the two convictions that there is some minimal good, beauty in life, including my own, and that what finally matters, even to me, is the life of the whole, the something that includes me, outlasts me, save as I contribute to it, and contains more good than I can distinctly imagine. Contains more good than I can distinctly imagine." You ever have those days where you're just so down and out and you can't imagine any good in the world? Those are the moments when you want to remember there's more good in the world than you can possibly imagine. The essence of process thought is to engage in creative and rational existence with the wholeness of all things of which we are a part. And to understand that just because it is in our own experience, that is the limit of the possible. The world is alive with feelings and experiences all its own, and we are but small and miraculous piece of that world. We are but cells in the larger body of this planet, and this planet is but a cell in the larger body of the solar system, and the solar system a cell in the larger body of the galaxy, and so on. We are infinitesimal and yet relevant. The essence of process thought has four key components. I won't go into them deeply, but I think that they are relevant to our consideration of what does it mean to be in this season, in a time of wonderment and moral imagination, to be in a place that is outside and yet apart. The first key point of process theology is a reality that in all its manifestations, the world is both subjective and objective. There's a wonderful episode on Futurama. Yeah. Futurama is a cartoon. It's really kind of for adults. It's not really a kid's show. And at some point, they're watching this race. And person crosses the line, and one of the key characters loses a bet, and he says, "Oh, he observed it, so he changed the outcome," which is a great physics joke. The bottom line being that we have learned through science that sometimes the observer changes the reality, that the universe is both objective and subjective. We know this in a lot of different ways. In our race conversations, we know that there was a time in the 1800s when Thomas Jefferson said, "Science will discover that there is a key difference between people of different races." And guess what happened? Science proved that there was a key difference between different races. And guess what? It was wrong. We now know there's actually no scientific basis for a definition of race. The world is subjective and objective all at once. So one of the key things about the holiday season is an embrace of humbleness, of being humble in the world. And so we must recognize that with all the power of our moral imagination, of our wonder, of our mentality, of our reason, we must recognize we are at once objective and subjective observers of our world, and therefore prone to be wrong. And also prone to be right. The second point is that at some incipient level, everything is alive. Even this wood, which within it has molecules moving so fast that we wouldn't be able to observe it. It would be beyond our capacity to understand. In a very literal way, this piece of wood on this pulpit is moving. The very seats on which you are sitting are moving so fast you can't comprehend it, which is a good thing, because if they weren't moving that fast, you'd fall right through them. Everything is alive. The third point is that the whole defines its parts. And I think that that's something that's powerful within process thought. It isn't just that we are individual agents, and I think there is some comfort in thinking that as individuals we have great power. The truth is we're part of something bigger, and if that something bigger decides that it's done being a planet, we're kind of done, right? That's the level of, you know, we are a part of a system that's much greater than we are, and we have no control over it, which again leads to that humbleness of the season. And then the final one is that relationships form the matrix of mutual becoming. In other words, we create our world together. Sunshine alone on an island would go crazy. We'd probably start talking to a soccer ball like one Tom Hanks did. You know, any one of us would have that. But in community, we create meaning. We create possibility. And our own individual moral imaginations may not create a world that is better and more whole, but certainly together, that's another possibility. We are part of a miraculous world, intricately woven and ever-changing. And in this season of closeness and cold and chaos and calm, we are invited to pause for a time. We are invited to pause and to take stock. We're invited to take stock and be appreciative. Appreciative not just of our own experience, but of the wonderment that is out in the world and the universe and in the experiences of others. 4 o'clock in the morning, in a time of silence, is a great time to be in wonder. It was probably 2 a.m. My mother woke me up. I was 6 or 7 or 8 or 9. It happened almost every year. Get up, get up. Go outside. My father and I would go and put up chairs, sometimes in the snow, sometimes in the summer. My mom would make popcorn, and we'd sit down and watch the northern lights for hours. A time of wonder and a time of space and silence. And I'm sure you have your own telling of such experiences. That is the stuff of the holiday season. That is the stuff of being a humanist in a holiday, a time of wonderment at the power and beauty of the world and of people. It isn't to say that there are moments of the mundane or even of deep struggle. It's a both and. Just as Hartshorne realized that joy happened in the world, whether he felt it or not, we recognize that there is much to celebrate in life if we are hard-pressed to find it. Being humanist for the holidays means being in a state of reasoned appreciation. Being humanist for the holidays means being grateful for the miraculousness of the cosmos of which we are a part. It means engaging our moral imaginations to imagine the possible in the face of a broken world. And so may you be witness to small moments of wonder. May you embrace the power of the moral imagination that comes from this time of year. May you share that wonder with the world around you. May you share your own wisdom and be open to the wisdom beyond your own experience. In short, May you be fully human, small and yet a part of something larger. And may it be so. I invite you now to rise as your spirits and bodies allow and join in singing hymn number 295, Sing Out Praises for the Journey. Face across the chandelier and turn towards one another. In the spirit of humanism, where we recognize that it is in our minds, our hands, and our hearts that the world is transformed and made anew. And yet recognizing that we are a small part of allness of everything, may we know that we are supported by the care of this community. Go ahead, give each other a smile. Just as a man on a cliff, not sure of the world, so your smile reminds us that we are not alone and that beauty exists in the world. So go and share that beauty in a world that needs your light and your love in the spirit of all that is well reasoned and well imagined. May it be so.